question, requests, or be auspicious for that. With the first offering, I would expect on basis in the beginning. The chariots is to at least see the public park. Otherwise, it's useless to even try to do anything. Without their mercy and blessing, nothing is auspicious. Let me ask this first question. How many of you read the chapter? Okay, everyone. That's good. So what we'll do today is, in order to get a balance, is we'll discuss the 9 questions first, and then we'll read chapter 3. Okay? And first we'll go over the 9 chapters. There's no need to read chapter 2. And then, so the first half of the class will consist of discussion on these questions. Okay, so let's see. Did you bring any of your material in? Okay. So, lesson number 2, 9 questions. Briefly describe the 3 categories of your devotional service and their characteristics. It does mention that. For whatever the chapter has mentioned, we can do that. Hare Krishna. Welcome. Mother, what is your name again?
Ileana.
I-L-L-A-N-A?
I-L-I.
I-L-I-L-A-N-A. Okay, just so I can get your name right. I'll just call you Bhattaji. Did you read the chapter?
Yeah, I
don't know. You didn't read it, okay. So, did you do the questions?
I did some of them. Okay.
Did you have, do you have any questions with you? The first thing we're going to do is go over the questions. That'll be the beginning. Okay, so the first question is, briefly describe the 3 categories of devotional service and their characteristics. So, it mentions, but it doesn't give the characteristics of this one. Where did that question come from? You can mention the first one. What is the first category of devotional service? What is it called?
Practice.
And what is the characteristics of those? There's how many? 2 categories.
Sadhana
and Bhakti. Blend it together. That's the question number 3. So let me see how what I actually said here in terms of that. So really, the 3 categories, I think that is enough. The characteristics are actually mentioned in later sections of the Nectar Devotion. And we really can't get into the categories. But they mentioned the 3 categories.
I wrote out later, a couple pages later, the practice means applying logic and sense following regular principles.
Okay, what is write a short description of devotional service and practice now. Okay. So we'll take one question at a time for each person, and then we'll make it a discussion if it's necessary. Okay, who wants question number 2?
We'll just answer this.
Devotional service.
And practice of one of my senses and service under the order of the spiritual master. Following
the regular principles of the goal of becoming attached to Krishna. Okay. And devotional service and practice. It's called what?
Sadhana.
Sadhana. What?
Sarana Bhakti.
Sarana Bhakti. That's a sarana. Sarana Bhakti. What is the two okay. It's divided into two categories. What are they?
Vari and Raganuga.
Vari Bhakti means, as you explained,
following regulated principles.
Okay, with the goal of
becoming attached to Krishna.
Yeah. Okay. So in Vaidhi Bhakti, it's not just, it's preliminary, but in essence, the idea is to become attached to Krishna through rules and regulations. So the rules, the idea is that the rules and regulations are meant to help you become attached to Krishna. And when we say rules and regulations, rules means things to do, regulations means more or less restrictions. So things to do and things not to do. So how, this is for further discussion. Now how does things not to do help you become attached to Krishna?
Become detached from material things?
Or more specific, you can catch the material things or being attached to things that are
contrary to devotional service.
Yeah. Or things that are unfavor or contrary to devotional service. Because if one is still doing things that are contrary, at the same time practice things that are contrary and that are conducive, and then the process is practically nil or slow. One has to practice giving up those things which are contrary to. And that, and there are certain regulations. Some things are regulated. So what is, name a regulation. What is a restriction?
No illicit sex.
No illicit sex, okay. So that someone is conditioned to act whenever they want to.
This
is our just nectar devotion class. You can sit in. So someone is inclined to acting any time they want like that. So therefore, it's restricted to marriage and even within marriage, only for procreation of children. So then there's all of a sudden a restriction comes, and that allows that activity to be performed, but under what is called religious principles or regular principles. So, otherwise, the activity, if it's not performed under regulative principles, takes one away from Krishna. So that's one example. There's a whole series of examples. You know, things not to do, which take us away from Krishna consciousness, because the purpose of sadhana bhakti is to get you attracted to Krishna. And if you're doing things that are going to take you, because attraction to Krishna is not some sentiment. You know, I'm attracted to Krishna. Yes, but if you're still attracted to those things that are contrary to devotional service, then really your attraction is not what we say founded on, what we say real attraction is based on just some sentiment which will change when things change also. So, of course, one may have some attraction for Krishna and still have attraction for things that are against the principles of. But if one doesn't act on them, then that's fine. But if they're still acting on them, then one's attraction for Krishna will not develop. Although the attraction still may be there for material things or even for sinful activities, still, if one is not acting on it, then that is not really taking away from that. Of course, one's consciousness will eventually become purified from that as they develop their attraction for Krishna. Really. Real attraction for Krishna. Not just, oh, Krishna's so nice, but one day and the next day he's not so nice. This is nice. Every day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, whether we experience it or not. Okay, so write a short description of devotional service and practice. briefly describe what is Vaidhi Bhakti. Well, that's also devotional service and practice. So Vaidhi Bhakti, I think you did it. This is not the same thing.
Yeah.
Following rules and regulations for the desire to get attraction to Krishna. Okay. Alright, we'll go on to the next one. All rules and regulations are subservient.
I think. Sorry.
Okay, any further discussion?
Yeah, on the previous one, man?
Yeah. Describe Vaidhi Bhakti.
Yeah, there was also a description, I think, very much Goswami, that Vaidhi Bhakti means that one has no attachment to Krishna and nor love for Krishna, but he's simply following out of obligation to the order of the spiritual master,
or
trying to follow the scriptures.
Right. Yeah, it's a sense of obligation. I do it because basically you got the essence, because it's the orders of the spiritual master. That's the description of Vaidhi Bhakti. What's the others? We're going to talk about the other aspect of sadhana bhakti in the previous question. What is the other?
Raganuga.
Raganuga bhakti, which is?
Spontaneous.
And what's the... How does this Raganuga, or does Vaidhi bhakti lead to Raganuga bhakti?
Yes.
No. It doesn't. Simply by practicing Raganuga, it doesn't necessarily lead to that. Spontaneous attraction develops when what? When spontaneous attraction develops, not simply by practicing Vaidhi Bhakti, but what is, how does spontaneous attraction develop? This is not a guest place. Do you know it? I stand in the back of the room on 1 foot.
It says, what I took from the book, Raganuga refers to the point at which, by following the regulative principles, one becomes a little more attached to Krishna and executes devotional service out of natural love.
Okay. But what happens? What does Vaidhi Bhakti do?
Gives you attached to Krishna.
Yeah. Do everything. Because the last thing you said is out of what?
Executes devotional service out of natural love.
In order to reach the stage of natural love, what must be one's condition? One must have a purified heart. In other words, Vaidhi Bhakti, practicing devotional service doesn't necessarily lead to Raganuga Bhakti if there is no purification of the heart. You can practice Raganuga Vaidhi Bhakti for 120,000 lifetimes, but if you're not getting purification of the heart, you're not going to come to Raganuga Bhakti. You're just not. So by practicing Vaidhi Bhakti correctly and becoming attached to Krishna through the process purifies the heart, and then spontaneous devotional service arises. But it's not simply by practicing that. There has to be the purification of the heart. And there's many persons who practice Vaidhi Bhakti for lifetimes, but never reach spontaneous. Because spontaneous devotional service is something that's quite rare.
Now, is that spontaneous devotional service? That's not, like, back to the first question, devotional service in ecstasy. We're still dealing
with still
the practice.
We're still on the practice, but it's practice has culminated to its second stage, which is spontaneous or Raganuga Bhakti. What is the characteristic of Raganuga? Well, now we're getting into things that may not necessarily be explained in that particular chapter. But what is the difference between the execution, not so much the mood, but what is the difference between how one executes Raganuga as opposed to how one executes the Vaidhi Bhakti?
Or my good example, Mahavarti. That one gets up in the beginning from Maharati because he obligated the instruction of the spiritual master, and then goes to decorate the deity out of instruction.
Mm-hmm.
But then when it comes to
the Rebbe knew the plan for mountain purification, and he actually does it very enthusiastically and very willing to do it and happy to do it.
Yeah, he's eager to do it. It becomes a natural attraction. It's no more an obligation. I guess you can use a material example. One is spontaneously attracted to something, or naturally attracted. There's a taste, a sweet taste that has arisen due to the association of that object through practice, and now it has reached the mature stage through purification of the heart, of course. Therefore, then it becomes. The question, the thing is, the one doesn't have to adhere to the rules and regulations in order to practice devotional service. One will adhere to the rules and regulations simply as a matter of example for others, or just. In other words, rules and regulations don't apply on the spontaneous platform because the rules and regulations are already subordinate. They have reached, one has culminated in that. But people follow the rules and regulations in order to show example for others on the spontaneous platform. Just like Prabhupada, give you an example. Prabhupada is in Vrindavan. So one day he came and looked out and to see who was in Mangalarti. And he noticed half the devotees were not in Mangalarti. So he called the temple president. And he said, where are the devotees? And the temple president, the Nanjaya, said, some of them were still sleeping. Prabhupada said, tell them they must come. It's a must. I would come, but I have my translation to do. I can only do it at this time. But in the real sense, Prabhupada doesn't have to go to Mangalarti because he's not going to fall down if he doesn't. But the devotees need to go because it's part of their purification. But one who's on a purified platform, if they don't follow the principles, if they then they don't fall down because they have achieved the goal of the principles through the practice. The goal becomes not a set, the activity doesn't become rules and regulations anymore. It becomes spontaneous attraction. So if one doesn't follow the rules and regulations anymore, it doesn't mean they're fallen. It simply means that they may just be serving Krishna in another way at that particular time. You have to see the difference. That's why one should not imitate another devotee, because if you imitate another person's activities, you can fall down. Imitation and imitation is a way to become corrupt in devotional service. That's a good, just an example. Okay, so that's Sadhana Nibhakti. That's the other part of Sadhana Nibhakti. Any discussion on Raga Nuga Bhakti? Okay, number five. Someone read the question.
All other rules and regulations are subservient devotional principles. To which rule? Not the answer. The principle of remembering the Supreme Personality of Godhead constantly and not forgetting Him at any moment is meant to be followed by everyone without fail. So remembrance of the Supreme Lord.
Okay. But that's half of it. What's the other half?
Not forgetting
Him. Okay. So, all rules and regulations, the rules are called, what's the Sanskrit word for the word rule?
Yeah.
Who knows? This is outside of the discussion, outside of it. The rule is vidhi, vidhis, V-I-D-H-I-S. Nidhis means rules, and nishedas means regulations. And there's a verse that all the rules and regulations are subservient to this principle: always remember Krishna,
never forget Krishna.
Okay, so what? So that's the highest principle. That if one is always remembering Krishna, never forgetting Krishna, then all the rules and regulations are automatically being followed by that principle. So what is the mistake one can make in interpreting that? What is the mistake one can make in interpreting that concept? This will make you think a little bit. So okay, I know that the supreme goal is to always remember Krishna, never forget Krishna. And therefore all the rules and regulations are meant for that. So what can one mistakenly conceive? Ilana. Just think. Whether you know or not, think. So think about that. Okay, someone tells you, you don't have to do anything but remember Krishna and never forget Krishna. So what would you say?
I don't have to do anything but remember Krishna.
Yeah. What one might mistakenly conclude?
You can do anything.
That's right. Remember him, so you don't need to do anything.
Yeah. It means that all I have to do is remember Krishna. I don't have to do anything else. And how is that a corruption or a misunderstanding of that principle?
Would you all follow?
You don't follow, but what are you thinking then?
Thinking that you're okay
with your thinking. I just go, all I gotta do is think about Krishna, and if I don't have to do anything else. But what is the purpose of all rules and regulations?
Remember Krishna.
To help you remember Krishna. The purpose of rules and regulations is to purify your consciousness so you can remember Krishna. But if you assume that I can just remember Krishna and your consciousness is not purified, then you fall down. Because you don't follow anything. So that's the corruption of that. All right. Sounds good. I'll just remember Krishna and never forget Krishna. But it's not remembering Krishna is not simply a thought process. It's something that arises through purification of the heart. And it comes by following rules and regulations. So rules and regulations purify the heart and engage one in devotional service with that. Where one reaches the stage of always remembering Krishna, never forgetting Krishna, naturally, not artificially, where one has to think, oh, I should remember Krishna. Oh, okay, I'll remember Krishna. No, you just remember Krishna. It's natural. Just like it's natural to breathe. No one has to, you know, teach you how to breathe. Or you're not even conscious of the fact that you're breathing. But still, it goes on. So in the same way, a person in that stage, they just don't forget Krishna. It's just that natural. It's just part of their consciousness. They have reached the stage of purified consciousness. So it's not something they have to try to do. It's the mature state of bhakti. There's a difference. Okay? We'll get into the intricate aspects of this. Okay, what is the path of our... Why is the path of argument neither safe nor conclusive? Why is the path of argument neither safe or conclusive? Let's see. Who hasn't answered yet? Okay, go ahead.
Because... out of speculation, you'll become convinced by some argument you make out of speculation. And then someone comes and defeats your speculation with a greater argument. And then someone comes and defeats his speculation with a greater argument. And this way, there's no conclusion. Everyone's just defeating each other.
Yeah.
No conclusion.
That's what goes on in the world for that. Somebody comes up with a great thought process, and someone else comes along and defeats it. It may not come along right away, but, you know, what we say. Philosophical arguments are inconclusive. The truth of the self-realized is hidden within the truth of religious principles are hidden in the hearts of the self-realized selves. So truth is not simply become established by argument. It's simply established by the words of the Lord coming through the words of His. So the path of argument is not a safe place to be.
Is that similar, that process that they're describing, dialectical? I think that you were talking about the other morning in class.
Well, that's the nature of we say Western philosophy,
mm-hmm.
or any kind of, even some Eastern schools, many schools, is that there is observation, there is hypothesis, experimentation, and then there is, you know, gathering of facts, and then there's some kind of conclusion based on all these principles. But then someone else comes along and adds something, or adds their own facts, or takes away certain facts, or gives, and then there's another conclusion that comes. So you study the history of Western thought specifically, and you'll find it's like that. One philosopher is a philosopher because he studied another philosopher, and he's added his own realizations to that, and he's taken it to another level, or maybe he's taken it to a lesser level, who knows. But, you know, and therefore you have different schools of thought. So you go to school and you learn all kinds of schools of thought, but you come out completely bewildered because you don't know which one is the right. Well, I like this one. Well, I think this one's nice. Well, I'll choose this one. So yata mata tata pata. That one's okay, he's okay, you're okay, I'm okay, they're all okay because they're all schools of thought. And whatever one suits you, you can adopt them. That's your way of life. And therefore, it's all based on, you know, personal realization of where you come in contact with. Well, so where's the standard? Where's the foundation? Where's the principle of what we say? Something that is not changeable. Because Prabhupada explains that truth is, finish the sentence, truth is, or recreate the sentence and explain the point. Truth is what? What makes truth truth?
It's eternal.
Yeah. It's not subject to change. Something that's changeable is not truth. Something that is changeable is not truth. And so someone comes along and changes it, so where's the truth? I mean, it's called sophistry at best. Sophistry means what? What's the word sophistry? Anyone know? You ever come across that in your reading? Sophistry means half-truth. People speak today most of the time half-truths. There's always an element of speculation along with a little element of some kind of fact there. But it's always the fact is added, the fact is, their speculation is added to the fact. It's called philosophy. Something is, truth is truth. Krishna is God. That never changes. I am Krishna's servant, that never changes. That's true. Okay. Any more? Can I ask you a question? Okay. So number 7. Read the question, someone. Go ahead, Jeremy. Jeremy.
Explain what it means that devotional service is a continual process. No one can take the devotional service unless he has had some previous connection with it. For example, suppose in this life I practice devotional service to some extent. Even though it is not 100% perfectly performed, whatever I have done will not be lost. In my next life, from the very point where I stop in this life, I shall begin again. In this way, there is always continuity. But even if there is no continuity, if only by chance a person takes interest in a pure devotee's instruction, he can be accepted and can advance in devotional service.
Okay. So pure to refer, so devotional service is continual.
Mm-hmm.
But it requires some previous practice to begin. So there is attraction and there's previous practice. In other words, in order for one to begin, one has to have some previous connection with it. But even if one doesn't have any previous connection with it, how may one begin?
Pure devotee.
Right. The mercy of the pure devotee. So, when we have that play of attraction and practice, we see that what came first? Is it the attraction or is it the previous practice? Well, it says here that generally no one can be attracted unless they have previous practice. But then if you don't have previous practice, how can you become attracted? So where is it? The mercy of the pure devotee. Allows one to begin the process of devotional service. And Dhammal Krishna Goswami asked Prabhupada, you know, we don't have any pious activities. We don't have any qualifications for performing devotional service. How is it we have come to devotional service? Prabhupada said, I have created your pious activities. In other words, Prabhupada is giving his mercy. So the spiritual master gives his mercy to someone, and that person is benefited. And that's his discretion. He can give his mercy accordingly.
And Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that from an unsuccessful transcendental service, that we can take birth in the family of aristocratics. You know, of course, if he's very fortunate, he takes birth in the family of devotees. But say I practice devotional service, I'm unsuccessful, so I take birth in the family of aristocratics. So I keep that devotional service, yet in this life as an aristocrat, there's every chance I can fall back into Maya because I didn't forget devotional life. So what happens to such a person? Say I get pulled away from devotional life due to being born in an aristocratic family, then again I start to take to all type of vikarmic activities, and then I'm stuck again in this vicious cycle.
Yeah. So what are the four opulences that are given that show that one has either the pious credits or devotional service? Who knows that verse?
Janmashvadi
Shrutashvir Ekamar Neva. So what is it? Janmai, Aishwara, Shruta, and Shri. These are the four opulences. So Janma means?
Birth
in a pious family. Janma Aishwara means birth with
opulence,
riches, wealthy family. Money. Shruta is
education.
Birth with a good ability for learning, learning good brain. And Shri?
Beauty.
So these are the four, what we say, boons that one may have due to their past pious activities. So what can happen when you have these things? One can again use these things in order to try to enjoy material life. And then one is pulled into that. So what happens? So, but because of one's previous pious and devotional credits, one will come in contact with the process. But whether one takes it up or not, that's up to them. If they get so immersed, you know, just like a lot of times people bottom out in their material life due to having all these things, and then somehow or other they come to Krishna consciousness. You know, they're frustrated. They have all these things, and they may have met one or many of them in excess, but somehow or other. But then somehow or other they come across a devotee. They get a book, they meet and they take some prasadam, and all of a sudden they're again attracted to their fingers, activities. So they'll get a chance. Whether they take it or not, that's up to them.
What verse are you referring to?
That's the prayers by Queen Kunti in the Srimad Bhagavatam. First canto, 8th chapter. That verse is mentioned. So that whole chapter practically is prayers by Queen Kunti. So that's one of the verses there. So, well, what can we say about that? Material qualifications are
disqualifying.
They're good and they're both not. They're qualified. They're disqualifications and qualifications. But in Kali Yuga, they tend to be discomplications in this age, because there's so much opportunity to use them for sinful and irreligious activities. Especially in Kali Yuga.
So is it possible, let's say, sorry, I'm just curious.
No, at 5 o'clock I want to start the next chapter, so I still have 20 minutes.
So let's say I perform a lot of recurrent activities, and I take birth as some type of animal, lower species of life, but that devotional service credit is still there from how whatever previous life, but now I'm just looking at life as an animal.
Well, we get... That's the next question, right? That question is not part of the reading, but I threw that in there anyway. Well, what's question 8 is?
What danger is prevented if one performs devotional service?
So you answer the question. What is that danger? There's a verse in the Bhagavad Gita that explains that. Who knows that verse? What is the translation?
There is no loss within the relation. The first line is there is no loss within the relation.
There's no loss of diminution. And what's the next line?
Those who progress on this path save them from the greatest
suffering. A little advancement on this path, a little advancement can save one from the greatest type of fear. So Prabhupada explains the greatest type of fear is to lose the opportunity for devotional service. So that means to fall down into the animal species like that. So one who performs devotional service will not fall down into the animal species. Even if you, said Prabhupada says, even if you take prasadam once in your life, you're guaranteed a human birth. Even if you're sinful.
The more prasadam we take, the better.
There is a story of a king who. Which
one? But that's an exceptional story. That doesn't follow the rule. Because what was he given? Although he took a deer birth, what was his situation?
He could still remember.
Yeah, but when you never, no animal can remember the things. Maharaj was given a special facility. Why? Because he was very high on the path. Practice of devotional service. And he made a little inattention. So this is dangerous because the material life is so constituted that even though one is very advanced, if they're not careful in association with the material energy, they can slip. Mm-hmm. And if they slip, you know, it's not that they're going to take an animal birth, but they can be, you know, back in the material world again. But in the case of Bharata Maharaj, Krishna wanted to teach him a lesson and gave him an animal birth, but at the same time gave him his remembrance of his previous life, which allowed him to do what? Because he remembered his previous life, what did he do? What didn't he do? Both.
He didn't social about the deers.
He didn't hang around with the deers. He didn't want anything to do with deers, even though he was a deer. He hung around with what? The sages. He would go by, he would be a deer, but he would just walk around and stay with the sages. So that was it. There's one deer at New Vrindavan that she came from. What's her name?
Gaurangi. I think her name is Gaurangi.
No, it's Rangini.
Rangini?
Yeah, something like that. Rangini. Not Gaurangi. Rangini. Yeah, she was like a baby. She just wandered into the community and they adopted her. I think one day she left her. Got tired of the devotees. Too much austerity. Okay, so that's not the answer to the question, Nick. That simply by performing devotional service in any capacity, one is guaranteed a human birth. Okay, because but there is some wretched human births. Persons who have very terrible human births because maybe they perform devotional service, but they've committed a lot of offenses. But still, they get the human births. But still, they're in a very miserable, a very unfortunate condition. That's also. Why is it easier for those who have a taste to execute devotional service? What is the answer to that? Why is it easier for those persons who have a taste to execute devotional service? Yes. There's one word that really answers the question, but go ahead.
They're less likely to speculate and argue, thus they'll be more submissive and absorb the teachings.
Yeah, very good answer. Well, this covers the word. And they're in the first looks, the second half, they're more likely to be absorbed in the teachings.
Yeah, they're more submissive.
Is that in the reading? Or did you come up with that?
It's a natural taste and understanding for the Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam will manifest.
Yes. Yeah. A natural taste. And the natural taste, and one when one has a natural taste, what do? They make a commitment. So that's the word I was looking for. They commit themselves to devotional service if they have a taste.
Oh, yeah, I got that from devotional service is easier than for those who are simply accustomed to mental speculation and argumentative processes. Which half of those good?
So taste means attraction, and attraction means commitment. If you're not attracted, it's very hard to be committed. Okay, so these are the questions from chapter 2. Any other further discussion on chapter 2? Anything else that you may have found of interesting that you want to discuss?
So they never really get into anything outside of devotional service and practice in this chapter?
Generally, no. Yeah. Okay. It's because this, you look at the name of the chapter. What is the name of the chapter?
The first stages of devotion.
Okay. Okay, so now what we'll do is we'll read the third chapter. Everyone can participate in this, and then we'll discuss as we go along. And at the end, I'll give you a whole series of questions for chapter 3. So we can read the chapter Okay, who would like to begin the reading? Okay, Phil. So I'll be interrupting the reading, so just read along.
Chapter 3, eligibility of a candidate for accepting devotional service. On account of his association with Mahatmas or great souls, 100% in the devotional service of the Lord, one may attain a little bit of attraction for Sri Krishna. But at the same time, one may remain very much attached to fruitive activities and material sense enjoyment and not be prepared to undergo the different types of renunciation. Such a person, if he has unflinching attraction for Krishna, becomes eligible candidate for discharging devotional service.
Hmm. So if one has that attraction, although they still are attached to fruitive activities and sense enjoyment, that's rare. That's right. But if it, in other words, it's possible. If one has that unflinching attraction, the Lord is still attracted to other things. Okay.
This attraction for Krishna consciousness is in association with pure devotees is the sign of great fortune. It is confirmed by Lord Chaitanya that only the fortunate persons, by the mercy of both the bona fide spiritual master and Krishna, we get the seed of devotional service.
Okay. Only those who are fortunate will get the seed of devotional service. So everyone has an opportunity to come to devotional service, but only those who are really attracted will get the seed. The seed is given at initiation.
In this connection, Lord Krishna says in Srimad Bhagavatam, 11th canto, 20th chapter, verse 8, my dear Uttava, only by exceptional fortune does someone come to be attracted to me. And even if one is not completely detached from fruitive activities or is not completely attached to devotional service, such service is quickly effective.
Hmm. The Krishna is saying, you know, one is attracted to me, their service is quickly effective. So what does that indicate? That type of attraction, what does that indicate? And also they have desires for fruitive activities and sense gratification. What does that attraction indicate?
That is stronger.
Something it indicates. We've just discussed that in
Previous practice?
Yes. And it indicates that there's been some previous practice there. Okay.
Even though there's an indication that there was some previous practice was there, but it says here that only by one who accepts fortune, you know, and find that one who doesn't accept fortune. So still, there's kind of some implication that, you know, there was no previous practice, but I was just fortunate enough to accept fortune, and some good fortune came in when I was accepted. That's also, I mean, by the verse, that's also kind of indicated.
Yeah. Yeah, well, to be able to recognize the value of devotional service pretty much means that there has to be something there. Because, you know, if you give it to most people who don't practice any kind of pious or religious activity, they just think it's a waste of time. What's the benefit? You know, better to work or better to enjoy the senses because you get immediate satisfaction and results. So there has to be something there. But there is the exception to the rule, especially in this case. But when we discuss these things in detail, we see that really, you know, generally a person who's attracted to Krishna consciousness but still has attraction for sense gratification. Generally, that attraction for sense gratification has been there, but there has been some devotional attachment attraction in previous lives that is starting to manifest. It just happens naturally. They become attracted. So, the idea is to continue and then your attraction for futile activities and mental speculation will gradually fall away. One continues the devotions. Once you're not to get discouraged, oh, I'm still attached to Maya. I'm still attracted to sense. I can't give it up. Krishna says, never mind. If one is trying to give it up, although they can't give it up, then that's their qualification. But if one stops and then gives up trying, then that becomes the one then starts going back into that realm of material life again. Even if you're the most fallen, if you continue with the process, one will make advancement. Okay. So remember, this devotion, this nectar devotion, is the science of bhakti, which goes into the real intricacies of devotional moods here. Okay, next paragraph. Who wants to read? Who's ready?
Yes.
Okay, we'll just go this way there.
Yeah. Devotees may be divided into three classes. The devotee in the first or uppermost class is described as follows. He is very expert in the study of relevant scriptures, and he is also expert in putting forward arguments in terms of those scriptures. He can very nicely present conclusions with perfect discretion and can consider the waves of devotional service in a decisive way. He understands perfectly that the ultimate goal of life is to attain to the transcendental loving service of Krishna, and he knows that Krishna is the only object of worship and love. The first class devotee is one who has strictly followed the rules and regulations under the training of a bona fide spiritual master and sincerely obeyed him in accord with revealed scriptures. Thus, being fully trained to preach and become a spiritual master himself, he is considered first class. The first class devotee never deviates from the principles of higher authority. He attains firm faith in the scriptures by understanding with all reason and arguments. When we speak of arguments and reason, it means arguments and reason on the basis of revealed scriptures. The first class devotee is not interested in dry speculative methods meant for wasting time. In other words, one who has attained a mature determination in the matter of devotional service can be accepted as a first class devotee.
Okay. Any questions based on that? Yes.
There's a couple of different questions. Okay, being fully trained to preach and become a spiritual master himself, he is considered first class. By fully trained, to me it seems like there's a lot of, it's almost too much to really be fully trained. So when I hear you speak about different things, I wonder how did Maharaj learn all this stuff, because his association with Prabhupada might have been like just not full on, like going through books and things. And, so I guess my question, what does it mean to be actually fully trained?
What does it mean to be fully trained?
There's a verse in the Svetas Vatara Upanishads. One who has implicit faith in the instructions of both Krishna and the spiritual master, all the imports of all revealed scriptures are automatically revealed within the heart of that devotee. So the word is strada, or firm faith. So if one has full faith in all the instructions of the spiritual master, coming by way of his books or coming by way of his devotees, one studies, imbibes them, and practices them. Because the spiritual master is not the body. Spiritual master is the principle that engages one in devotional service. And the element he engages in devotional service is by his vakya, his words. Guru Mukha Padma Vakya Chite Te Koriya Akya. What is the translation? Guru Mukha Padma Vakya Chite Te Koriya Akya Arana Koriya Maniyas. My only aspiration is to be absorbed in the instructions of my spiritual master. I'm attached to hearing his words. His words are my food. His words are my life. His words are what I live for. That kind of conviction makes one fully trained when they apply those instructions in their life. So, in many cases, one doesn't necessarily require the personal association of the spiritual master. But they must be in contact with his bhakti, his words. So fortunately, in this age of Kali, we have many nice mediums, such as recorded lectures. The spiritual master's voice is there, and he's giving his explanation. So it's practically almost the same as associating with him directly. And then his words and his books are none different than him. And then one who follows the words and the instructions of the spirit. And there's two aspects to the spiritual master's instructions. His words of philosophical teachings and his practical instructions for engaging in devotional service. What you should do as a disciple. And what you should understand as a disciple. Two aspects. So by both of these aspects, if one absorbs themselves in that and practices in that, one is associated with the spiritual master. And one is being trained by the spiritual master. Okay? So that's first class training.
Only the other one was just about it said something where my only concern is to love Krishna. Love Shri Krishna.
He knows that. You say Shri Shri, you better say Shri Shri Radha Krishna.
Shri Shri Radha Krishna.
You say Shri Krishna, that's
something. What is Shri Shri Krishna?
Shri 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 means like you just added a Shri onto a Shri.
Oh.
What does Shri mean?
Auspicious?
No. That's correct. Shri means beauty. Yeah, Shri means beauty.
Yeah, you said that earlier.
Okay, so you're looking at here, as he says here, and he knows that Krishna is the only object of worship and love?
Right.
So what's the question?
My question is, if the devotee's only object of worship and love is Krishna, how does he turn that into love for his family, for people, and other things around them? Of course, I've heard that, he sees Krishna everywhere, he's never lost, but, still, how does a person see others and relate to them in love without it being just pure maya?
When, I'll give you the answer in one sentence, when you see everything connected to Krishna. When you see things separate from Krishna, then you make a distinction. When you see everything connected to Krishna, and then if you have love for Krishna, you naturally have love for those things that are connected to Krishna. The devotee loves everyone because ultimately he loves Krishna. A neophyte devotee loves only Krishna. Second class devotee can see the connection between the Lord and his energies. It makes no distinction in terms of his relationship with it. He loves the Lord. And he also sees that everything is connected to the Lord, and he uses all other objects for the Lord's service. So basically, in a practical sense, if you love your wife or your children, you serve them as your service to Krishna, and at the same time, you engage them in Krishna's service. You serve them and you engage them. That's your relationship. So you're in serving them, you should know what your duties are in relationship to that kind of service. There's family duties, that's called Grihastha Ashram. Someone has to study what are the rule principles of Grihastha Ashram. That way we practice that, connecting these objects with Krishna in the proper way, according to the principles of the ashram. Okay. First class, any more questions on first class? Okay. Anyone knows what a first class? Okay, now second class devotee. Who wants to meet that?
Yeah. The second class devotee has been defined by the following symptoms. He is not very expert in arguing on the strength of revealed scripture, but he has firm faith in the objective. The purport of this description is that the second class devotee has firm faith in the procedure of devotional service unto Krishna, but he may sometimes fail to offer arguments and decisions on the strength of revealed scripture due to an opposing party. But at the same time, he is still undaunted within himself as to his decision that Krishna is the supreme object of worship.
Okay? So he has faith, and his faith is not completely developed, but it's strong enough where he's not going to be deviated. But at the same time, he cannot put forth all arguments based on his emotional life. So, what is being said here? What is the connection? What is the classification of categories of devotees? What are the two things that are mentioned here? How is a person categorized as first, second, and so on? What are the things? What is the word that's being used?
It seems according to his ability to present the scriptures.
So one thing is knowledge, and what is the other one?
Faith.
Faith. Faith and knowledge. Faith and knowledge are the characteristics that describe a devotee in each category. The strength of their faith, the development of their knowledge. So we say no dummies allowed. Movement is not for dummies. Why? Because mind is too strong. If you don't have a working knowledge of this philosophy, you will be defeated by mind. So you have to know the philosophy. Or you have to have strong attachment to the spiritual master's instructions, even if you don't have a lot of knowledge, but you're fixed in the spiritual master's instructions. That will save you from being deviated. Even if you're not so well versed in scripture, but if you have faith in the instructions, that'll save you. That'll keep you fixed in devotional service.
What about you kind of just answered my question, but when we're saying knowledge, I'm thinking of preachers like yourself. What about something like Vishvakarm or other devotees who are not in that capacity, but at the same time they're very devoted. Obviously, they have the faith in the process.
Well, I mean, that may be discussed in different ways, but it explains that there's one verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam that says, by rendering devotional service, one attains causeless knowledge and detachment. So simply by engaging in devotional service, one develops, you know what we say, knowledge and detachment from life. So, and then that knowledge is knowledge of one's relationship with Krishna. And that knowledge, if one is fixed in their service, that is an indication that they have understood the conclusions of all knowledge, to be fixed in one's devotional service. And you see a person such as Vishwakarma, what does he do? He's there and he's serving, and he's every day serving. So he's fixed in his service. He's convinced that this is fifth is this one, he wants to give his life into mercy and service. So that's a qualification of understanding the truth. Because the real purport of all knowledge is to engage one in is to be fully engaged in devotional service. So if you're doing that, it means you have knowledge. And you're not going to be deviated, even under difficult circumstances.
So they're just presenting the knowledge in a different way.
It's knowledge in action, yeah. 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 It may not be well versed in the scriptures, but that doesn't matter. Still.
Is devotional service in that sense, could it be said to be the same as Kriya, like Kriya Yoga? Do the words have any like similar?
I'm not exactly sure what Kriya means. Kriya Yoga is a combination of bhakti and mystic yogic mysticism. A mystic yogi basically still has material desires, but he performs some devotional activities. And so mystic Kriya Yoga is still, you know, somewhat tainted by personal desire. It's not bhakti. It's a mixed form of bhakti. It's like Jnanamitra bhakti. It's not Jnanamitra bhakti. Not even that much, because their desires are still, you know, on a material level. And then the goal is different. The goal is not to love Krishna. The goal is to use Krishna in order to get to what they want. Krishna is part of the whole problem. There's two things. To have Krishna as your sense gratification, and to have Krishna as one of the objects, one of the categories of your sense gratification. So there's many people who have so many categories of sense gratification, and Krishna is one of them. And there's so many people who have one form of sense gratification, Krishna. Krishna satisfies my senses. Both are, what we say, not pure bhakti. One is better than the other one. One is exclusively depending on Krishna for his sense gratification. Because the desire for sense gratification is still there, and Krishna is fulfilling that somehow. Through the process of doing some service for Krishna or doing something. But it's still me-centered. Although Krishna is the center of my me-centeredness, it's still me-centered. And then there's those who have many categories of sense gratification, and Krishna is one of them. That's lesser. And that's basically like, you know, these other yogas, like Krishna just fits in there somewhere. So many other things are in there too. Bhakti means exclusive devotion to Krishna. Free from all personal sense gratification. It's not then, although the senses are being satisfied, it's not sense gratification. It's what is called the happiness achieved from devotional service. It's different. Okay. Next one, third class of one, someone want to read.
The neophyte, a third-class devotee, is one whose faith is not strong and who, at the same time, does not recognize the decision of the revealed scripture. The neophyte's faith can be changed by someone else with strong arguments or by an opposite decision. Unlike the second-class devotee, who also cannot put forward arguments and evidences from the scripture, but who still has all faith in the objective, the neophyte has no firm faith in the objective. Thus he is called the neophyte devotee.
He can be swayed by stronger arguments.
So that's why association is very important in the beginning.
Exactly. Very good. Association gives one the strength to overcome that deficiency. And also remembering the instructions of the spiritual master. Even if one has not realized the instructions of the spiritual master, but still has faith in him, when something comes along, they can say, well, my spiritual master said this, and this is what I follow. Although it may be somewhat, you know, undeveloped in their understanding, still they have faith that this is the right thing.
Yeah. And I remember one class that you were actually given, you were explaining that in the Kali Yuga, no one can be defeated because no one accepts defeat in Kali Yuga. Like previously, you can actually defeat someone on the basis of revealed scriptures with a stronger logical argument, stronger philosophy. But now, even if you defeat them, they won't accept. So better just to say, you have your program, I have my program.
Well, I was just contemplating this point today. And, you know, generally people don't come to Krishna consciousness through being philosophically convinced. It's very rare. People come to Krishna consciousness because they're suffering in material life, generally. That's why people come. No one comes out of philosophy. You know, I have a strong working knowledge of philosophy. If they do, when they come to Krishna consciousness, that same knowledge, that same tendency develops fast in the philosophy of Krishna consciousness. So in previous ages, not previous ages, even in early parts of Kali, even during Lord Chaitanya's time, and in general a lot of times, if you were to discuss something with someone and you were defeated, then you would have to somehow or other accept another person's philosophy. Or because they actually become his disciple. Otherwise, there would be no reason to discuss. What's the idea of discussing? It just becomes an intellectual exercise with no gain. I defeat you because it's my false ego to defeat you. That's all. But that's not devotional. So the idea is to. Therefore, we don't engage in debates. Debate is another form of useless talk, because there's no conclusion. But if the debate is based on the principles where one accepts the superior argument and adheres to that, then that type of debate is good. Lord Chaitanya debated with Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, but what happened? Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya became, you know, a devotee because of that. So people wear their philosophy not as a way of life, but as an ego. Yeah. That's all. Yeah. And if you challenge their philosophy, you're challenging them. So what's the use of a discussion? Because no one really... So therefore, sit down, listen, learn, behave, and just hear the truth. And if you're not interested, well, what can I do? I'm not going to sit there and argue with them. I've got to waste time in arguing. There are certain rare exceptions where argumentation may bring about the results of a person changing their attitude. But generally, it's very rare. Especially in Kali Yuga. Very rare. You need it all the time. Let me give you an example. I mean, there's one. I don't want to get too far into this because we have other. But one time, Giriraj Swami was out on sankirtan. So the Mayavasi philosophy of that is everything is one. Everything is one means it's all the same. So one man he met on the book exhibition. So he said, yes, it's all the same. Everything is one. There's no difference. So Giriraj Maharaj said, okay. If everything's the same, then give me all your money. Because whether you have the money or I have the money, it doesn't matter. It's all one. So the man, in order to support his philosophy, took out all his money and gave it to Giriraj, which was over $100. And then, a little later on, he came up to him and said, can you give me $5? I need a bus. I have to get my transportation back to my house. Man was pretty good because he believed in his philosophy. Another example was when we were at the Kumbh Mela, and it was cold at the Kumbh Mela, really cold. So there's one Mahavadi, he was preaching that same thing. So, what was his name? Achyutananda Swami said, "All right, you have the blanket, and therefore, why don't you give me that blanket? Because whether you have the blanket or I have the blanket, there's no difference. So, and since it's all one, that the thread and the blanket is all the same, so I'll take the blanket and you have the thread." So he took a thread out of the blanket and gave him, said, "Here, you keep one with that." But when you get right down to the practical application of your philosophy, it's philosophy. It falls apart. So, but how many people accept? They wear their philosophy simply as an ego trip, that's all. And if you defeat them, they take it personally. But real philosophical debate is, I'm trying to learn what is the highest principle. Therefore, if you can show me something higher, you're my friend. And then I surrender to you. I'll accept that. That way I come up in life. But that's not Kali Yuga. That's just how people think.
I heard Prabhupada in addition to what you're saying about Mayavada, especially not just the Mayavada philosophy, but even most of the philosophies we hear today, all types of things. Prabhupada said, "This is not a philosophy you live on. It's not a philosophy you live on.
You live on."
Yeah, it's not a philosophy you can live on. Just right. For speaking mostly.
Yeah, it's not something you can make a living on. It's not a way of life. It's a way of devotion. Okay. Any other points on neophyte third class devotee? Everyone can categorize themselves according to write down your category privately. Which one are you?
It's funny because reading descriptions of you, sometimes the false ego makes you think, I have at least half the qualifications of the first one, I'm at least on the second one.
You'd be surprised. You don't know. Someone come along with some really powerful arguments. You think, well, I know a lot. And all of a sudden, there's people who are expert in argumentation. I can present things in very interesting ways. And you won't be able to defeat them unless you have a working knowledge of this. You may even be swayed in your Krishna consciousness. I can give you some opposing arguments, but I won't. That's right. Make them doubtful. What they are. Many strong opposing arguments. Okay, so continue.
Prabhupada would say that he was said to be able to defeat his devotees when they took the side of a bhakta, and he took the side of a mayavada, right? He said to be able to defeat them with mayavada philosophy.
Yeah, there's, in other words, a devotee in the first class position is so expert that he can take the opposite party and defeat a devotee. I've seen it. I saw that many times. A devotee who's expert in the scriptures or expert in Mayavadi philosophy takes that position and can explain it in such a way that the devotee can't defeat it. I saw that many, a couple times. But because Mayavadi philosophy is what? What is
Vargadagri.
It's simply an interesting way to present the word. But if you know behind what they're saying, you can see. But if you don't know the scriptures, you can't defeat it, because they quote scripture too. Right. That's why most philosophers in this day and age are impersonalists in my bodies. Because it's a theory that fits into Kali Yuga. Why is it fit into Kali Yuga? Because Kali Yuga is the age of everything is more or less based on sense gratification, economic development. So Krishna has presented a philosophy that you can become spiritual in Kali Yuga, but it's not spiritual. But you can defeat them all in one word. And they say everything is illusion, then we say yes, even your philosophy is illusion. Everything is illusion, so is your philosophy, so why should I listen to you? You have to know the arguments. There's a whole book on how to defeat Mayavadis, and there's a whole website now that's developing on discussion on how to present arguments against Mayavadis and atheists. Atheistic conceptions are very strong nowadays.
No.
What's this book called?
Yeah.
The book I have it upstairs. I forgot the name of it. I can show it to you.
Oh, it's
Anyway, don't consider yourself so advanced until you actually come across and face to face with these arguments and be able to defeat them. Right now we're just sitting in our little corner in Chicago and we're discussing some little philosophy. When you get out there and you're face to face with this stuff, it's a test. You may not fall down, but at the same time you may not be able to convince them either. Or even defeat them. They may even defeat you. But you may not. So we have to see what it really means to have a working knowledge of the philosophy. And to have faith in that. Like that. Practice. Okay, let's continue. Further classification of a neophyte devotee.
Further classification of a neophyte devotee is made in the Bhagavad Gita. It is stated there that four classes of men, namely those who are distressed, those who are in need of money, those who are inquisitive, and those who are wise, begin devotional service and come to the Lord for relief in the matter of their respective self-satisfaction. They go into some place of worship and pray to God for mitigation of material distress, or for some economic development, or to satisfy their inquisitiveness. And a wise man who simply realizes the greatness of God is also counted among the neophytes. Such beginners can be elevated to the second class or first class platform if they associate with pure devotees.
Okay. So what does Krishna call these four classes in Bhagavad Gita? What's the word Krishna calls them?
Pious.
What's the word he uses?
Sukriti.
Yeah. They're all Mahatma. Why? Because they've come to the right place, even though they've come for other reasons. So out of the four, which is the best?
Right of knowledge.
Okay. And what's the second one?
Inquisitive.
These two are considered to be, the other two are simply on the material platform. One who's curious or one who wants to know the truth. The other two, one who coming out of distress and coming out of money. What happens to those, what may, here's a question, what may happen? Well, I'll write this down as a question. This will be one of the questions for me. What may happen to one who comes either out of distress or in need of money? What may happen once they get their desire fulfilled in devotional service? What may happen? You just answer maybe one of the questions. What may happen to them? What could happen? we'll save that for discussion. Let's continue reading. Any discussion on that? Four classes mentioned in Gita. Practically, most people come to our temple fall in one of the two categories. They're suffering, so they want to come to God to relieve their suffering, or they come to God because they want something material. It's easy to see it. You know, they come to the church or the temple and they pray for something material. It's called Naimittika Bhakti. That means worshipping the Lord for something material. It's not real bhakti, it's more like Prabhupada said, this is merchant. But if they come by, if they actually take up devotional service because of these reasons, then that's different. But if they simply approach the Lord in order to get these reasons fulfilled, but they do not take up devotional service, then that is called Naimittika, or merchant. But if they come because of these reasons, that's a lot better. They actually engage in practical devotional service. Because they're miserable, suffering from material life, or if they want some economic gain through practicing devotional service. Okay. Next, who wants to read an example? Who's the name? Eliana? Or, I'm sorry, Mahabala Nitai Purple? Do you have the book there?
Mm-hmm.
You have a book?
Yeah.
Okay, read. The next paragraph. The last one on page 30.
An example of a neophyte class is Maharaj Dhruva, who was in need of his father's kingdom and therefore engaged himself in devotional service to the Lord. Then in the end, when he was completely purified, he declined to accept any material benediction from the Lord. Similarly, Gajendra was distressed and prayed to Krishna for protection, after which he became a pure devotee. Similarly, Sanatana, Sananda, and Sanat Kumara were all in the category of wise, saintly persons, and they were also attracted by devotional service. A similar thing happened to the assemblage in the Namasharanya forest headed by the sage Sunaka. They were inquisitive and were always asking Sutta Goswami about Krishna. Thus they achieved the association of a pure devotee and became pure devotees themselves. So that is the way of elevating oneself. In whatever condition one may be, if he is fortunate enough to associate with pure devotees, then very quickly he is elevated to the second class or first class platform.
So the association with pure devotees can bring one to the perfectional stage of practice. Okay. Dhruva Maharaj wanted a kingdom greater than his great-grandfather Lord Rama, which has never been heard of in the association of anyone. His father was Uttanapada, who was the king of the world. His father's father, or grandfather, was Swayambhuva Manu, the Manu for that age. And above that was Lord Brahma. He wanted a kingdom even better than Brahma. That was not the formulation. So he approached the Lord for it, and when the Lord revealed himself to Dhruva, he forgot. And not only, no, he not only forgot, he was embarrassed. He was literally embarrassed to ask the Lord because he felt ashamed that he approached the Lord for something material. So the purport of that, which is really a powerful point, is that our material desires seem important, but as we experience Krishna in devotional service, we see through that progression of experience, our material desires become, let's say, insignificant, distasteful, unimportant, and even abominable. And Jamunacharya, the great Jamunacharya, what was his situation? He's king of the world, and he had all royal happiness. He became degraded. There's the whole story of the life of Jamunacharya, which is really interesting. But Prabhupada quotes his one verse and he writes, that now that I think of sex life, I get disgusted, and my lips curl, and Prabhupada says, Prabhupada uses the word, I spite on it. Instead of saying spit, Prabhupada says spite. I spite. So he had such attraction for Krishna that his old ways of, you know, abominable life, which was so wonderful while he was engaged in it, now became something distasteful, that even when he thought about it, it became disgusting to him. So that's the power of Krishna consciousness. That's the power of Krishna consciousness. Same with Dhruva. Dhruva wanted a kingdom. When he saw Krishna, he was embarrassed even to even have that desire. He didn't even ask it, but he was embarrassed. And Krishna did what Krishna did. He gave it to him anyway. He gave Dhruva the kingdom. Became the pole star. Because he wanted to do something for his pure devotee. He offered him what he wanted. But Dhruva was no longer interested. So that's devotional service. We may have so many desires, and that's okay, but if we continue in our devotional service, these things will fall away and we'll be replaced with the sweetness of our devotional attraction for Krishna. And then these things fall away. Like a person who's madly in love with another person, they can't think of anything else. You know? And if that other person goes away and their love is disappointed, they can't sleep, they can't eat, they can't think, they can't function. And you look at the world, nothing it seems, they look at all their possessions in their room and it just like looks like one big miserable dreary void, right? You've experienced that in your life, having some loving relationship with somebody that falls apart and your heart's just devastated and the whole world looks empty, everybody looks horrible, right? Like, ah! I can't live anymore, nothing means anything, I mean, it's real, but that's what it's like when you have Krishna consciousness, that everything around you, you know, what you saw so wonderful before really doesn't have any value anymore. I mean, in terms of, you know, it has value now in its relationship to Krishna, but before, you lost all attraction to trying to enjoy it much more. That's Krishna consciousness. So wherever you are, don't give up. The path is auspicious and the goal is guaranteed as long as you persevere to the end. The Prabhupada said, anyway, how many lives you've been using for yourself? Just give this one life to Krishna. That's all. Just give one life. That's all. Just asking this one life. Just give this one to Krishna. How many lives have you taken for yourself and now you're still miserable? Give this one to Krishna and you'll see. You'll never be a loser. Guaranteed. When do we leave off? Still got 20 minutes, so we'll go for another 15 minutes of reading and 5 minutes, and we'll go for our questions for the next class. But please ask questions as we go along here if you feel that there's something relevant based on the reading. Ileana, you can read.
The four types of devotees have been described in the seventh chapter of Bhagavad Gita, and they have all been accepted as pious. Without becoming pious, no one can come to devotional service. It is explained in Bhagavad Gita that only one who has continually executed pious activities and his simple reactions in life have completely stopped can take to Krishna consciousness.
Who knows that verse? What verse is that in Bhagavad Gita?
Chapter 7:28.
7:28. What is that?
Vishnu Chandra Katam
Kyanamam Punya Kramanam Tvaidanda Nirma
Nirma Pajanti Madhurita Bhatta.
Yeah. Translation?
Only for those whose sinful vice have been completely eradicated.
Sinful, simple activities have been eradicated in this life and in previous lives. Yeah. Can take the devotional service. And what's the last word?
Dhrita
Vrata means what?
Great determination.
Okay. Others cannot. A neophyte?
Neophyte devotees are classified into four groups. The distressed, those in need of money, the inquisitive, and the wise. According to their gradations of pious activities, without pious activities, if a man is in a distressed condition, he becomes an agnostic, a communist, or something like that, because he doesn't firmly believe in God. He thinks that he can adjust his distressed condition by totally disbelieving in him.
You experience that someone they go to God and then somehow or other still they're not happy, so they decide it's easier not to believe in God, then it makes life much more easier. So I think that's the solution to their problems. Taking up some ism or taking up some cause in the world. Okay. Continue, reading one more.
Lord Krishna, however, has explained in the Gita that out of these four types of neophytes, the one who is wise is very dear to me. Because the wise man, if he is attached to Krishna, is not seeking an exchange of material benefits. A wise man who becomes attached to Krishna doesn't want any return from him, either in the form of relieving distress or in gaining money. This means that from the very beginning, his basic principle of attachment to Krishna is more or less wrong. Furthermore, due to his wisdom and study of Shastra, he can understand also that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
Okay. Any questions? We continue. Someone?
Yeah, the part where it says the devotee doesn't want anything from Krishna, not even money. Like in the household, where's the fine line? I mean, from you saying, okay, I don't want anything from Krishna, and then saying, okay, but Krishna, I want you to take care of my family. How do you approach that?
Well,
for asking or
taking care of the family is what? What are you doing?
You should be service.
Yeah, well, you're serving. Yeah, you're serving Krishna through serving your family. So then we might say, in order to do that, it's just like, say, if you want to wash the floor, you need a broom or a mop. Something. So you need some paraphernalia to do your service. So some of the spiritual master says, okay, wash the floor. And you say, well, there's no brooms or mops. That's okay. You don't need it. Just wash the floor. You might say, well, you're asking me doing the service, but I don't have any. So in doing a service, there are certain things that are required. So in maintaining one's family, under the facility of money is an intricate part of that. So it's not seen as separate, it's seen as part of. You see it separate, then it's personal. You see it's part of the service. Then you're getting money in order to do your service. That's all. Okay?
Yes.
But yeah, one has to be careful not to accumulate more than necessary. That's the fine line. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Continue.
It is confirmed in Bhagavad Gita that after many, many births, when one becomes actually wise, he surrenders unto Vasudeva. I know perfectly well that Krishna, Vasudeva, is the origin and cause of all causes. Therefore, he sticks to the lotus feet of Krishna and gradually develops love for him. Although such a wise man is very dear to Krishna, the others are also accepted as very magnanimous because, even though they are distressed or in need of money, they have come to Krishna for satisfaction. Thus, they are accepted as a broad-minded Mahatmas.
Why are they called Mahatmas? Because
they come to Krishna.
They come to Krishna. Even though it's material still, they come to the light place. Okay.
Without being elevated to the position of a Jnani, or wise man, one cannot stick to the principle of worshipping the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The less intelligent are those whose intelligence has been taken away by the spell of Maya are attached to different demigods on account of the influence of the modes of nature. The wise man is he who has thoroughly understood that he is spirit soul and not simply a body. Because he realizes that he is spirit and Krishna is the Supreme Spirit, he knows that his intimate relationship should be with Krishna, not with his body. The distressed and the man in want of money are in the material concept of life, because distress and need of money are both in relationship with this body. One who is inquisitive may be a little above the distressed and the man in need of money, but still he is on the material platform. And a wise man who seeks Krishna knows perfectly well that he is spirit soul or Brahman, and that Krishna is the Supreme Spirit Soul, or Parabrahman. He knows that the Spirit Soul, being subordinate and finite, should always dovetail himself with the Infinite and Supreme Soul, Krishna. That is the relationship of the wise man with Krishna.
So you can see the gradations here. Now the first two are material, one's a little bit better, and the last is really the true Mahatma, because he has come for the right reason. The other ones will also may learn after a period of time, but they may not. Okay. So if you want further information about this, this is Bhagavad Gita chapter 7, verse 16. And then you can read the purports that we had discussed in the 16 and 17 of those verses. Everyone's following? It's interesting, boring. Like the devotion is the science. It takes you into the subtle aspects of the science of devotional service. It makes the whole process exciting. And you really know the intricacies behind the whole process.
And
now we're laying the foundation. Yes.
The two on the bodily platform, the distressed and the need of money, are they? There's no gradations between those two. They're at the same level.
Pretty much the same. One may be in need of money, may be a little bit. You know, he's not. You know, his material, he still may be pursuing material life, but he understands that And I can, not on money, but anything material. The word money is used, but really means anything material. Most people in this age, out of those two, come because of distress. They turn to God because of distress. And that's all right, that's fine. Because Kali Yuga is the distressful age. But they're basically, man in need of money might be a little bit more. And then according to devotional categorization, I don't think it makes a difference. According to material categorization, it might be one is a little better materially off. Okay, so what we can do is stop here, and then I'll give you some more questions and continue. There's only another page and another full page to read for the end of the chapter. Finish the reading. Go back over. And I'm going to add another aspect to the thing is that we're going to learn a verse too. Sanskrit and English. Okay, we're ready. And that is that verse that describes pure devotional service. Ayan vilasita sunya jnana kamana navritam anukulena krishna sivanam bhakti uttamam. Where is it listed? Verses are not mentioned in this book because Prabhupada translated everything into English, including the verses. But it's also part of the text. It's mentioned in the introduction, but you have to find a verse book. Something where the verse is mentioned. It's found in verse books, I guess.
Where is this a verse from Nectar Devotion or from Bhagavad Gita?
It's categorized as Nectar Devotion. You look for BRS, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. You see that those three letters next to the verse, that means it's the BRS. It's the here. It's called the definition of pure devotional service. And it's mentioned in the introduction. Let's see. You want me to find it? We can find it. On the page 24 of the introduction. Prabhupada explains the whole thing. Definition of a pure devotee is meaning the service is favorable and always in relationship to Krishna. That's the explanation of the verse.
So how do we find this verse, Mahaprabhu?
Yeah, it's in all verse books. Have you ever a verse book?
I don't know what a verse book is.
Where else can we find it?
It's in Bhagavad Gita.
It's in the purports of Bhagavad Gita. Just look up, get a Bhagavad Gita. I'll give you the, what is the first word? Anya. A-N-Y-A. Anya Vilasita. A-N-Y-A-V-I. Anya Vilasita. Sunyam. And I would also recommend those who are serious about learning this even more and get, there's a book called Waves of Devotion. I think Jerry can vouch for that. He was looking at my book the other day. It's a further commentary on this. It breaks it down farther. It's called Waves of Devotion. Beautiful book given by Dhanadhar Maharaj. Very comprehensive study of nectar devotion. And if you read that, and along with this, you'll be a pundit in nectar devotion. Really get into the intricacies of the discussions. It's called Waves of Devotion. Okay, don't go yet. I'm going to give the questions now, and then you can go. Okay, the questions are for next. Assignment is, question is, first one is, write an essay entitled the three classes of devotees. And just write an essay about the three classes of devotees. This is only going to be four questions, that's what I'm going to get. Plus the first one I gave you was four or five.
Good question.
That's up to you.
Very good.
Write an essay entitled The Three Classes of Devotees.
Is it going to be turned in, or everybody going to read it aloud next week?
We'll read it and discuss it. This is all discussion. I'm not into doing homework. You do the homework. We bring the homework to class.
Which we probably don't want to.
Yeah. No, I mean, I could take this class and a step farther and give you grades, but I don't think that's what we want to do. After we go through the book once, and the second time, we're going to do it. The first time, we'll just go through it. Discuss how the wise man is the best among the four categories of pious people, and give a brief description of the three classes of devotees. Discuss how the wise man is the best among the four categories of pious people. And give a brief description of the three classes of devotees.
Isn't this and give a brief description of the three classes of devotees, what we're doing in the essay?
Yeah, it's also like a link. That's just like the same one. Yes, I found an overlapping. None of these questions are coming from me. Let me just give a brief description. I don't know, it's redundant here. Now, question number three, what is the perfect conception of spiritual life?
What is the perfect
conception of spiritual life? And in the second part of the same question, compare it with the other two conceptions of life. And the last question, forget that one, is establish that happiness in devotional life is the highest, and analyze eligibility for such devotional service.
can analyze the principle of eligibility. Establish that happiness in devotional life is the highest, the devotional happiness is the highest, and analyze eligibility for such devotional service. Okay, that's it. That's those questions. That's some of the questions for a little bit more.
Okay.